I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. This presidential election season has revealed some profound divisions in the country along gender, racial, ethnic, economic, and class lines. Our guest J.D. Vance has written an important book about what it's like to be poor, to be working class, and white. Hillbilly Elegy, a memoir of a family and culture in crisis, is about growing up in communities in Ohio and Kentucky that have been hollowed out by the loss of good jobs and opportunities, and where violence, unemployment, and addiction have become a way of life for many people. Vance was one of the lucky ones. He went to college and Yale Law School and now works at a Silicon Valley investment firm. He's written for National Review. We asked J.D. Vance to join us to talk both about his life and about the appeal of Donald Trump to whites who have given up on the American dream, lost their faith in institutions. J.D. Vance, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. You begin your book by talking about poverty as a family tradition for families like yours, others who are of Scots-Irish descent. Describe this kind of poverty that you lived and we're going to be talking about.
Yeah, well, so in the family I grew up in, my grandparents were from Eastern Kentucky, coal country. They grew up extremely poor in that part of the world, and then migrated north like a lot of, like, frankly, millions of other Americans in the search for a better life in the northern factories. And as I write the book, they found it in a certain way. So they definitely earned a good middle class wage for most of their lives. But as they found out, culture and class were a little stickier than they expected. And so by the time that I came around, a lot of the wealth that they had spent a long time accumulating had sort of disappeared. And certainly by the time that they died, it had disappeared. And so that's really what the book is about, is sort of this problem of what we think of as the American dream. But we find out that, you know, for a lot of families, the upward mobility of the American dream eventually became the downward mobility of something else.
You write about something that you call Appalachian values. On the one hand, it served families like yours, and on the other hand, it created problems. Describe what you mean.
Yeah, well, so it was a pretty rough and tumble world in a lot of ways. So one of the things you really learned to value was your family's sense of honor, your family loyalty, and your sense that you really owed something to your family, both financially and culturally. And like I said, these traits are good and they're important, but at the same time, they create certain pressures. They create pressures sometimes to violence that obviously isn't super productive if you're trying to live a successful life. They create pressures to not leaving, not going and getting an education, not going and finding a better life for yourself. That also can be, good because it keeps you humble, but it can be bad, right? Because it can create certain self-destructive tendencies to not get out when what, at the end of the day, you need to do is go and find education and employment elsewhere.
You talk about, and frankly, you write about the violence that you grew up in, whether it was in your mother's house or even being raised by your grandparents who fought bitterly. I mean, at one point, your grandmother was so angry at her husband for coming home drunk again that she set him on fire. I mean, this isn't sort of the regular violence, I think, that we're used to hearing about.
Yeah, I think it existed in my family at a very extreme degree, though I will say that if you look at the data, if you look at the prevalence of childhood trauma in working class families, it's a lot more common than we might like to think. And so, some of the best data that we have suggests that around 40%, so almost half of working class children experience multiple instances of childhood trauma. So it may have been relatively extreme in my family, but it wasn't all that uncommon relative to the neighborhood and the community in which I lived.
In fact, you describe friends, parents, basically just arguing with each other a lot. I mean, arguing that you could hear outside playing and you could hear them arguing in their house or perhaps their trailer.
That's exactly right. That's definitely the case. It was the sort of place where you heard people fighting a lot. You heard them fight in restaurants and you heard them fight in the house that was next to yours. So there was definitely a sense that the people in the community, that they just had this approach to conflict. And I didn't realize that there was something unique about it until I got older. I thought that's just how everyone lived. But of course, I was in some ways just taking what was a very unique value that existed in my class and in my culture and sort of projecting it onto the broader world, which I learned, you know, wasn't the case.
You do describe in loving details, particularly your grandmother, but also your grandfather, as you say, raised and rescued by loving people. Looking at your bio, looking at the fact that you went to Yale Law School, what does that tell us?
Well, you know, what it tells me at least is that it's very important to have a loving and stable home if you want to have, you know, if you want to have children, have any opportunity at what we call the American dream or upward mobility. At the end of the day, I had a lot of people who ensured that I had access to opportunities and to stability that I wouldn't have had if I hadn't had my grandparents, if I hadn't had my sister, if I hadn't had my aunt and my uncle. You know, these things, we tend to talk about the economics of these issues, which I think is very important. We should talk about the economics of these problems. But a lot of times what really holds kids back is the lack of access to a good, you know, a good home or a stable life. And that's something important that we should also talk about.
Tough love. How would you describe the love that your grandmother had for you?
Well, yeah, it was definitely tough love. I mean, as you probably realize, if you've read the book, she was a pretty wild woman. And I mean that in the best way. But, you know, she was very tough. She was very demanding, and that she provided those things at a time when I really needed them. But she was also very perceptive. And I think she recognized in a lot of ways that the environmental pressures I was exposed to in my community, the pressures I was exposed to in my home, they were starting to have an effect on me. And I think she recognized that and tried to counteract that in a lot of ways. She really tried to encourage me to think that no matter what was going on in my life, that there was still the hope for a better future, so long as I was willing to go out and try to find it. And so that's, you know, what was so amazing about Mamaw, as I called her,
right,
is that she recognized that life was unfair for us. She recognized that other people had it easier than we did, but she also always kept her optimism in the future that we could control our own destiny. And I think that was a very, very difficult balance to strike, but she did it incredibly well.
And she saw that your mother really was incapable of taking care of you.
Yeah, that's exactly right. She did, and she made sure that I had, you know, the opportunities that maybe, you know, my parents couldn't provide for me. She stepped in at moments when she needed to step in. And even though she was old and sick, she was, you know, sort of the closest thing I had towards, you know, towards the middle part of my childhood to a stable home and a stable mother.
You describe your grandfather, as you say, your grandparents moved north looking for a better life, for a job. Your grandfather had a good job. It was a union job. He had a pretty good pension as well. And when you look at some of the communities that have been hollowed out and you see those jobs are no longer there, are the problems because of the fact that factories have moved away or shut down? Or is it something about culture or something about a combination of the two?
Well, I really think it's the combination of the two. I mean, one of the things that I try to emphasize in the book is that even though I'm writing primarily about the cultural and some of the non-economic pressures, I think it's very important to recognize that the economic pressures were there and were very important. At the end of the day, you know, we often have what I think of as a very ideological conversation about whether this is culture or whether this is economics. But I think that what's going on is that both is happening and they're obviously interconnected. Culture affects economics and vice versa. I mean, just to give a very concrete example, it's very hard to have a successful family, have a successful marriage if you're under economic duress, but it's also very hard to keep a job and to be a good worker if your family isn't stable like mine wasn't. So it's a pretty complicated and intertangled problem, but hopefully I gave at least some reason to think that complexity could be unpacked a little bit.
Let me read a couple of sentences from your book, and this is your memoir. You write, "We choose not to work when we should be looking for jobs. Sometimes we'll get a job, but it won't last. We'll get fired for tardiness or for stealing merchandise and selling it on eBay or for having a customer complain about the smell of alcohol on our breath or for taking 5 30-minute restroom breaks per shift. We'll talk about the value of hard work, but tell ourselves that the reason we're not working is some perceived unfairness. Obama shut down the coal mines, or all the jobs went to China. These are the lies we tell ourselves to solve the cognitive dissonance, the broken connection between the world we see and the values we preach. I underlined that. I circled it. I scored it. I just think that's such an important paragraph.
Well, yeah, you know, it is. I agree with you. I think that that is an important paragraph in the book. And you know, the point there is that for and I should say that, you know, that's not necessarily true of most people in the community. Right. So a lot of people are working hard, are trying to get ahead, and they just, you know, they've been hit hard by life circumstances. And I don't think we should discount that. But there is a significant minority of people who, you know, they aren't doing the things that they need to do to get ahead. And instead of sort of recognizing that problem, recognizing that it exists, they are perfectly willing, or maybe they just have to tell themselves stories about why they're unable to work, or why they're not working, or why they're not contributing more meaningfully to their families. And, you know, that's something that I think we have to fess up to as a culture and as a community, to recognize that there are both the really hardworking folks who are trying to get ahead but can't, but that there are also people in our community who are not being totally fair to themselves and are not maybe recognizing quite the role that their own agency is playing in some of their circumstances.
I mean, that's a hard thing to try to deal with. What do you suggest?
Well, you know, the reason I wrote the book is that I think the first thing I'd suggest is a certain self-awareness about the problem. You know, I don't think that we can go through, I think our politics suffers from this problem. I think that our personal lives suffer from this problem. But I don't think that we can go through life without at least admitting that there's a significant disconnect between some of the values that we preach and some of the actions that we take. And it's not just in work, you know, it's in family. We are, you know, traditionally associated with social conservatism. We talk, I think importantly, we talk about the importance of family and marriage, but we have skyrocketing divorce rates. You know, we talk about the importance of sort of doing well and living a good life, but we have much higher crime rates than we used to. So I think that the very first thing that we have to do as a community is sort of look ourselves in the mirror and say, look, some of these things, some of the values that we preach aren't necessarily practiced in our broader community.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. And I do want to talk about using, I guess, what you just told us and a bit about your family and your life to understand a certain segment of the population that has gravitated to Donald Trump. And that's J.D. Vance, author of a memoir called Hillbilly Elegy, a memoir of a family and culture in crisis. He's written for the National Review. He's been interviewed a lot on this book. There's a lot of important information in this book as well. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowing, talking with J.D. Vance about his new memoir called Hillbilly Elegy. Let me just segue from your own personal story to our political election, this campaign season. How do you understand the appeal of Donald Trump to the white people that we have been talking about? Is it his platform? Is it his language? Is it his biography? What do you think that is?
Well, you know, I think there are two basic appeals to Donald Trump. One is relatively illegitimate, and the other is legitimate. So the illegitimate one is I think that what Trump offers is a very simple solution to a series of complex problems that the community has experienced. So from drug addiction to family breakdown to rising joblessness and so forth, Trump basically says, look, here are some, you know, we're going to change our trade partnerships with China. We're going to build a wall along the Mexican border, and we're going to bring the jobs back. And I think that that's illegitimate, because at the end of the day, I think very few people think that Trump will actually help things. The more legitimate part of Trump is that he is at least identifying pretty significant problems that exist in the community, and he's making the community feel seen and feel heard in a way that it hasn't been by the political elites in at least two or three decades. And so, you know, if you think about a lot of these blue collar white Americans are increasingly feeling that the political elites look down on them, that they condescend to them, that they don't really care about the very significant set of social and economic problems that exist in their communities, then what I think you'll recognize is that they've been looking for a long time for someone who will break through the fog, who will say, look, I see your problems, I hear you, and I'm gonna build a platform around your particular set of concerns. That's what Trump has really done. If you think about the past 20 or 30 years of Republican politicians, you know, John McCain ran on the same platform as George W. Bush, and Mitt Romney ran on the same platform as John McCain. Trump is really the first person who has recognized that the Republican base is primarily the white working class, and he's really gone after him. And that's something pretty powerful when you felt ignored for a long time.
You know, reading your book and just the gobs of shows that we've done about this election season, I'm surprised there weren't more supporters of Bernie Sanders coming from the poor, the working class, and white, because he talked about trade deals, he talked about income inequality, he talked about a rigged system. I mean, he talked about it, frankly, without the vitriol that we've heard coming from Donald Trump. Why do you think, or perhaps there was a sort of quiet support for Bernie Sanders, but what do you see as the disconnect there, or do you?
Well, you know, there maybe is a slight disconnect. I will say this. You know, people actually really liked Bernie Sanders back home. I mean, you know, a lot of people weren't going to vote for him, but they at least appreciated, I think, his rhetoric and his approach to politics, the fact that he was hypercritical of Wall Street. Those things really did resonate back home. What I will say about Bernie Sanders is that, you know, fundamentally, he's on, you know, he's a Democrat. Obviously, he represents the Democratic Party. And even though he was anti-elitist in his approach to politics, I think a lot of folks feel so alienated culturally from the Democratic Party. They feel that it's fundamentally a representative of a kind of coastal elitism that they, even though they were sympathetic to Bernie Sanders, they weren't actually going to vote for him.
What, though, has the Republican Party done for poor and working class whites in this country?
Well, if you know, my view, and I say this as a Republican, is that the Republican Party actually hasn't done a whole lot in terms of substantive politics. But what the Republican Party has done, at least, is make itself culturally felt in these areas. You know, if you look at a map of sort of the parts of the country that are red versus blue, the parts of the country that are blue are almost exclusively along the coast and in large cities in the middle part of the country, whereas the Republican Party is effectively the dominant enterprise, political enterprise, everywhere else. And so there's something to be said for, you know, the feeling that there are fundamentally two Americas right now. There are the coastal elites and there's middle America. And a lot of folks, I feel, and not totally wrongly, that the coastal elites are on one side of a division and middle America is on another side of a division. And the Republican Party, for all of its faults, and I think Donald Trump is the product of a lot of those faults, the feeling that the Republican Party doesn't represent people and so forth, they are still Republicans because they, you know, the Republicans live in their areas and go after their votes. And again, are not quite as culturally disconnected.
Even though Donald Trump said during one of the primary debates he didn't believe in a minimum wage, there's certainly a numbers of stories about him ripping off people that worked for him that he decided he wasn't going to pay. I'm just curious about how that plays among people who are trying to work hard for a living and trying to better their lives.
Well, I don't think it plays especially well in the details, but it has to be set against the backdrop of a very long campaign, and not just a long campaign, but a sort of long cultural transition in American politics. I mean, I think that the most underappreciated part of Donald Trump, for those who, you know, reasonably want to talk about the substantive policies or the actual pronouncements of the candidates, is that they have to recognize that people who are voting for Donald Trump you know, whether you want to call it rural culture or Southern culture or whatever, they feel that the Democratic Party is fundamentally disconnected, that they, you know, look down on people like them, that they condescend to their set of values. And Trump, for all of his faults, has actually gone after these voters in a very targeted way. It's kind of hard to imagine someone voting for Donald Trump when you think about all the things that he said, right, until you recognize that on the other side is Hillary Clinton. And for a lot of people, Hillary Clinton represents the other side of a very significant divide.
Let me quote something else from your book. You write, Barack Obama strikes at the heart of our deepest insecurities. He's a good father, while many of us aren't. He wears suits to his job, while we wear overalls, if we're lucky enough to have a job at all. His wife tells us that we shouldn't be feeding our children certain foods, and we hate her for it, not because we think she's wrong, but because we know she's right. J.D. Vance, expand on that.
Yeah, well, it's really about, you know, I think that there's a conversation about what underlies a lot of the resistance to President Obama. And, you know, I certainly think that race and sort of racial anxiety is part of it. But I think there's something else that's much less appreciated, which is that Barack Obama is sort of the embodiment of what it takes to get ahead in the United States of America in a time when a lot of working class white Americans feel that they are the opposite of what it takes to get ahead in the United States of America. So, you know, Barack Obama, he's obviously very intelligent. He speaks extremely well. He has elite credentials from universities that seem somewhat foreclosed to a lot of lower class white folks. And if you think about that and you contrast him to, you know, where a lot of working class white Americans are living their lives, you know, they're not going to college. They're certainly not going to Harvard Law School. They don't really feel that the modern American meritocracy was built for them. And in some cases, they're right. And I think that Barack Obama came out on the scene right as a lot of people were starting to lose faith in the American dream. I mean, they see the American dream as this thing that was always, you know, open to them. And right at the moment where they feel something was being closed off to them, here's this president who is very, very good at you know, the American meritocratic game. And I think that's a really striking juxtaposition. And I think it explains a lot of the insecurity and the anger that underlies resentment towards the president.
J.D. Vance, thank you so much. We could go on. I really appreciate you joining us. And I found your book absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you for having me. Nice talking to you.
Nice talking to you as well. And again, his book is Hillbilly Elegy, A Memoir of a Family and Culture in Crisis. Well, let's shift gears now. Alex Jones hosts a talk show and has a website, InfoWars, that until recently operated on the fringes, trading in outlandish, racist, homophobic, anti-Semitic, anti-government conspiracy theories. But this election season, he has found a fan in Donald Trump who appeared on his show last December.
I just want to finish by saying your reputation's amazing. I will not let you down. You will be very, very impressed, I hope. And I think we'll be speaking a lot, but you'll be looking at me in a year or 2 years. Let's give me a little bit of a time to run things. But a year into office, you'll be saying, wow, I remember that interview. He said he was going to do it, and he did a great job. You'll be very proud of our country.
Well, I'm impressed. I mean, you're saying you're fully committed. You know, there's no future if we don't take this country back. Donald Trump, I hope you can help uncripple America. Thank you so much, sir. That you will be attacked for coming on, and we know you know that. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Our guest, John Ronson, first met Alex Jones back in the late 1990s when they videotaped a ritual at a private camp of the powerful elite in California called Bohemian Grove. Ronson has been following Alex Jones' rising power and popularity and interviewed him at the Republican National Convention this summer. He joins us on Radio Times to talk about how Jones and the alt-right have influenced the Trump presidential campaign. His Kindle single is titled The Elephant in the Room. And John Ronson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Do we have him?
Oh, can you hear me?
I can hear you. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
And it's nice to be here.
Did you imagine 18 years ago when you first met Alex Jones that he would be talked about by President Obama, by Hillary Clinton, that Donald Trump would go on his talk show?
No, I am astonished by Alex's rise. I should say, by the way, that the reason why I'm astonished is more to do with the fact that Alex shoes facts and reason. He makes stuff up. He makes crazy conspiracy theories up. That's more of a reason. Now, in your introduction, you were talking about Alex being anti-Semitic and racist and so on. I think within the context of the alt-right, Alex, especially when it comes to those kinds of issues, Alex is a lot more moderate than other people. But where he's not moderate is the invention of incredibly baroque conspiracy theories that have no basis in reality, yet Donald Trump is a very big fan of them and him.
In fact, you write, Alex is basically the most irresponsible man I have ever met. He uses his powers to inflame paranoia. He boldly makes stuff up to suit his weird agenda. Alex eschews facts and reason, and he definitely should not have political sway. Does he believe what he says?
No, I don't think he does. I say that what you just read out. I say with some affection, although it may not sound that way. There's a lot about Alex I like very much. He's an extremely talented broadcaster. He's like a kind of beat poet of paranoia. He broadcasts 4 hours a day, and his use of words is just extraordinary. But no, what I think makes him even more irresponsible is that I don't think he believes a word of what he says. When he says that the government is secretly putting chemicals into juice boxes to turn Americans gay, or that atheists worship Lucifer, or that Obama and Hillary are actual devils and they smell like sulfur, and so on and so on. I don't think he believes a word of it. He knows his audience loves to hear that stuff, and so he gives it to them. And in fact, I've been with Alex when he said things that I know he knows aren't true.
And that's John Ronson, our guest in the second half of Radio Times, talking about the rising popularity and influence of Alex Jones. Let me play. This is Alex Jones on his InfoWars show. This is from October 11th, which he claims that Obama and Hillary Clinton are actually demons.
Folks, I've been told this by high up folks. They say, listen, Obama and Hillary both smell like sulfur. I never said this because the media go crazy with it, but I've talked to people that are in protective details. I mean, they're scared of her. And they say, listen, she's a freaking demon, and she stinks, and so does Obama. And I go, like what? Sulfur. They smell like hell.
So that's Alex Jones. I know, I heard you go, I mean, I have to say, and I did some listening to Alex Jones in preparation for the interview, he makes my blood boil.
Hmm. Well, okay, the thing that annoys me the most, I've noticed actually lately since Hillary has been the nominee, he's been veering into misogyny a lot more than he used to. So that's obviously a kind of dangerous twist in his rhetoric. The thing that annoyed me most about Alex, me and Alex snuck into a secret club in Northern California called Bohemian Grove, where people like George Bush have these sort of strange pageants on the Saturday night, which involve papier-mâché effigies being thrown into bonfires in front of giant owls, stone owls. And me and Alex snuck in and secretly filmed it. And Alex came away from, you know, what was an odd evening. Alex came away telling his fans that we had quite possibly, maybe even probably, witnessed an actual human sacrifice. We may have seen an actual human being murdered in the forests of Northern California, which we definitely hadn't. And when Alex started, Alex brought out a video where he was making these claims, and I just despaired because, you know, there's nothing clinically wrong with Alex. Alex knows that we didn't see that, yet he put out that conspiracy theory. And in fact, a fan of Alex's tried to break into Bohemian Grove after watching Alex's video to wreak havoc because he believed what Alex had said.
Do you see him as dangerous? Entertaining? How do you see him?
I think it's dangerous to inflame paranoia in a listenership and viewership, some members of which are prone to paranoia. I think that's dangerous. I really don't like the kind of misogynistic turn in his rhetoric of late. If Trump got elected and brought Alex somehow into the fold, of course that's dangerous because we need our leaders to be reasonable and rational and to not spread blatant lies. And so Alex's very strong influence on Trump, I mean, it's a long-standing and strong influence. That's dangerous. On the other hand, I think if a lot of people watch Alex because he's genuinely good at what he does. He's genuinely talented at what he does. And, you know, there's that side of him, too.
And we're almost up in a break here. And that's just the sort of theatricality, the fact that he can go on the air for 4 hours and talk.
Yeah, and the use of words. I mean, it takes a kind of, I mean, some of your listeners may disagree, but I think it takes a kind of genius to come up with the idea that President Obama and Hillary Clinton actually smell of sulfur. And in fact, I think President Obama found that quite funny. He stood up on the stage and theatrically sniffed himself in response to Alex saying that. So I think President Obama saw the funny side of that too.
And that's John Ronson, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's a writer, author, and he's got a new Kindle book. It's called The Elephant in the Room. It's about the rise, the influence of Alex Jones. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. If you're just joining us, John Ronson is our guest. He's a writer, author of several books, including them, The Adventures with Extremists, The Psychopath Test, The Men Who Stare at Goats, and So You've Been Publicly Shamed. He's got a Kindle single called The Elephant in the Room about the conspiracy theorist Alex Jones and his rise in the presidential election this year. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. John, we were talking about the fact that Alex Jones claims that Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama are actually demons, and he knows that because they smell of sulfur. Well, here's President Obama responding to Alex Jones' claim that he's a demon, and this is at a campaign rally for Hillary Clinton back in October 12th.
I was reading the other day, there's a guy on the radio who apparently Trump's on his show frequently. He said, me and Hillary are demons. Said we smell like sulfur. Ain't that something? Now, I mean, come on, people. This, democracy does not work if you just say stuff like that. Or and apparently there are people who believe that stuff, and they're listening to it constantly.
So, John, what percentage of the U.S. population actually believe that stuff, to quote the president?
Well, Alex has, I think, several million regular listeners and viewers. The first time I went to Austin to visit Alex, he had three employees and he broadcast out of a child's bedroom in his house with rather endearing choo-choo train wallpaper on the walls, and he was kind of yelling his apocalyptic vision down an ISD end line. That was in 1999. I visited him again a few weeks ago, and he now has, I think, 75 employees approximately in this vast space, and he makes an awful lot of money. He's become extremely successful. You can hear the despair in President Obama's voice.
Yes.
I mean, these are hard times for those of us in the center, those of us who believe in conciliatory thought. And whereas these are exciting times for people who thrive on chaos and polarization, and Alex is definitely riding that wave.
And is that the appeal, then, the people that they enjoy believing things that aren't true? They enjoy the kind of hatefulness that comes from Alex Jones' mouth?
I think, you know, people watch and listen to Alex for a number of reasons. I mean, within the alt-right community, Alex is certainly a lot more talented and charismatic than people like David Duke, for instance, or a lot of people who work for Breitbart. Alex is more likable than those people. So some people watch because, you know, they admire Alex's talent. Other people watch because they're staunchly anti-globalist and see Alex as as an important voice. So people watch, and then some people watch, I think, because they are prone to paranoia, and Alex is giving them all the paranoia that they want.
Let me play one more clip, and this is Hillary Clinton calling out Alex Jones by name in her speech. This was following Trump's so-called alt-right following on August 15th.
It's also what happens when you listen to the radio host, Alex Jones, who claims that 9/11 and the Oklahoma City bombings were inside jobs. He even said, and this really just is so disgusting, he even said the victims of the Sandy Hook massacre were child actors and no one was actually killed there. I don't know what happens in somebody's mind or how dark their heart must be to say things like that. But Trump doesn't challenge these lies. He actually went on Jones's show and said, "Your reputation is amazing. I will not let you down." This from the man who wants to be president of the United States.
John, I mean, in certain ways, one can understand an anti-globalist point of view. Frankly, I agree with Hillary Clinton. That was absolutely disgusting, even horrifying, that somehow the victims of Sandy Hook, that was staged and that those children didn't die.
It's actually even worse than that. What Hillary didn't say is that a whole bunch of Alex Jones's fans and fans of other people who spread a similar conspiracy theory about Sandy Hook started bombarding the parents of children who had died in the attack, calling them liars. So it's actually even worse than what Hillary said. And Alex's response to that Hillary speech was that she was lying and that he had never said that Sandy Hook was manufactured using actors. And so I triple-checked. I'd already checked twice, and I checked for a third time. And Alex most certainly did say that. So much like his friend Donald Trump, Alex is a man who's very happy to lie and not feel embarrassed when caught lying.
Let me switch gears and talk a little bit about Roger Stone. You were at the Republican National Convention. You talked to, I don't know if you exactly interviewed him, but I guess you did interview him. You talked to Roger Stone. First of all, tell our listeners who he is.
Roger Stone is a veteran dirty trickster. He's been a political dirty trickster since Watergate. He was actually caught in the Watergate hearings when he was, I think, still a teenager. Jeffrey Toobin of The New Yorker calls him a malevolent Forrest Gump because he turns up in practically every terrible political change from the creation of the super PACs through to he was one of the Brooks Brothers rioters who stopped the recount in Florida. And now he's a very close associate of Donald Trump and was the man who introduced Alex Jones to Donald Trump. From where I'm standing, I think he's even worse, even more malevolent, and far less likable than Alex. He spreads racist conspiracy theories about how Huma Abedin is a Saudi spy He has a tattoo of Richard Nixon on his back. Probably worst of all, he used to run a lobbying firm with Paul Manafort, who was Trump's campaign manager for a while, that represented so many murderous dictators. They became known as the torturers' lobbying firm. He represented Mobutu Sese Seko and Ferdinand Marcos, and his job was to make those people seem more respectable in Washington, D.C. And now one of his main jobs in the Trump campaign is to be the kind of conduit between Trump and the alt-right, a truly cold and malevolent force.
Well, in fact, you say that when Donald Trump said there had been no drought in California, or that Muslims were celebrating after 9/11, then that can be traced to, if not Roger Stone, certainly the alt-right.
Yeah, and Alex Jones, too. When Trump said there was no drought in California, and in fact the water had been seized by government officials and fed to a certain type of three-inch fish, I think a few people thought that was an odd thing for Donald Trump to say, and it was practically word for word something that Alex Jones had said a few weeks earlier.
What does that? I mean, it seems like almost something.
There's no point in trying to rationalize.
No, I mean, it seems like something out of The Onion, right?
Yeah, I know. Apparently, look, I don't know that much about the feeding of endangered fish in California. Apparently, there's a slight grain of truth to the fact that some water is used to feed some endangered fish. Apparently, but I know no more than that.
Let me see what Brian from Westchester has to say. And Brian, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi there.
Hi there.
I just think it's really interesting, the conversation you're currently having about, you know, people believing these kind of conspiracy theories, and the conversation you just had about hillbilly culture, in a way. You know, I see this play out in my own life because my father is from a family of that Appalachian origins, and it's almost discouraged to get an education from them. I frequently see my grandfather, you know, making fun of people who decided to go get a college education, and he actually wasn't very supportive when I decided to get a master's degree. And then my mother's family is very, most of them are college educated. So it's just interesting to see, I think, that, you know, those kinds of people are encouraging a lack of education, and I think that makes them more susceptible to believing these kinds of figures.
What do you think about that, John? This is sort of connecting an interview that you weren't part of, but this idea, does this reveal a kind of educational fault line?
Well, you know, I wrote a book around 2000 called Them, which was all about the relationship between conspiracy theorists and the people that they believe are the secret rulers of the world. And I think it's important, you know, to note that there's always a rise of conspiracy theories on occasions when our leaders behave conspiratorially. So, for instance, there was a very big rise of conspiracy theories around the Iraq War, which was shown that we went to war on false pretenses. So I don't think it's fair to like lay all the blame for conspiracy theories on the people who believe them. At the same time, there is something compelling about trying to make sense of a senseless world, of course. Obviously, you know, the terrible truth is that the world is pretty much unruly and nobody controls anything. And that's a frightening nihilistic thought. And so, of course, conspiracy theories can sort of fill that chasm.
Is Alex Jones, is he a birther the way Donald Trump was or is?
Roger Stone is certainly a birther, the man who introduced Alex to Trump. He was one of the people who was encouraging Trump to spread the birther lie. Alex, I mean, I would presume so, but I don't know for certain.
We have an email from Paul. He says, I think the blanket dismissal of conspiracy theorizing by the elites has exacerbated the meritocratic divide your guest was referring to in his comments about anti-Obama sentiments. And I don't know if you live in England mostly, or are you?
No, I live here. You live here in New York.
Yeah. So what do you make of our country?
Well, I like it very much. I'm very fond of. I've been here for nearly 5 years now, and I agree. You know, it's when I spent my years with conspiracy theorists around 2000, I came to that very same confusion. It's condescending to lay all the blame on conspiracy theorists, given that our leaders frequently behave conspiratorially. George W. Bush did, Tony Blair did, no question. At the same time, I feel that this year is a particular time of crisis where we've never had anybody like Donald Trump before. And rising to power on the back of racist and conspiratorial sentiment is a whole new game. And now isn't really the time to be nuanced about it. I kind of think we should just be against it and then be nuanced again after the election.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's John Ronson, and we're talking about his Kindle single called The Elephant in the Room. John, you do end, and I'm just quoting here, but the alt-right's appeal remains marginal because of the huge majority of young Americans like multiculturalism. They aren't paranoid or hateful about other races, and you go on to there to say this is not Germany in the 1930s. I certainly have heard people say that they worry that this might be Germany in the 1930s. You're saying no need to worry?
Yeah, I believe that. I think there's a slight increase in irrational and paranoid thoughts because all of us on every side have become more divisive and polarized. I mean, as President Obama said back in July, you know, it's hard not to worry that the center won't hold. These are bad times for centrists. I say in my short book that it's like we all polluted the waters and Trump emerged from these polluted waters like a kind of mutant fish. So I think there is a small rise in the alt-right. There's a small rise in that kind of thought. But it's small. If you go and see a conspiracy theorist like David Icke now, he'll get maybe, you know, I went to see him in Brooklyn a few weeks ago. There was 1,000 people in the audience. Mm-hmm. If I'd seen David Icke in the year 2000 in Brooklyn, there'd be 1,000 people in the audience. There's not a huge groundswell because, as I say, you know, thank heavens, most young Americans think these ideas are crazy. They have their groups of friends are multicultural. I mean, I see that, you know, all the time when I go across America. So I think everything's going to be fine.
Well, thank you, John Ronson, for telling us that. We all need a little bucking up a couple of weeks before Election Day.
Thank you. Don't kill me if I'm wrong.
I certainly would not do that. John Ronson, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And he has recently released something called a Kindle single. It's called The Elephant in the Room, and about conspiracy theorist Alex Jones, his prominence in the presidential election. We played some clips during this hour of Radio Times. He's a writer and author of several books. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about this program. You can download a podcast of the show. You can find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. You can also check out our newsletter, and you can listen to us on satellite radio. I'm Artie Moscoe. Thanks for joining us.